So we are in week five of our session, which is session two. I know all the numbers get a little confusing. There's units and sessions and weeks. I don't know a better way to do it. But anyway, we're in week five of session two. And in this session, we are taking a first pass at getting a sense of what time, space, and knowledge, about how to approach time, space, and knowledge from a TSK perspective. And one of the things that I think stands out very clearly in this reading is that knowledge, in a very real sense, knowledge is central. I remember somebody asked me that question years ago. They said, well, are time, space, and knowledge all equally important? And in one way, the answer is yes. But in another way, the answer is that it's a transformation in knowledge that is at the heart, in our ways of knowing, let's say, that is at the heart of TSK. In fact, you could even go further than that. On page 24 of the reading from Sacred Dimensions, there's a statement. Here, let me find it. One moment. I have to get my book. There we go. On page 24, and that's Roman numeral 24, of course, it says in the second full paragraph, the TSK vision invites us to initiate our own questioning and to judge for ourselves how valuable such inquiry can be. That is the whole of its message. That's a very strong statement. TSK is an invitation to question. That's all that it is. No more. No more and no less. But of course, the kind of questioning we do depends on being able to question, you might say, with our whole being. And that means being able to bring time and space into play. One of the ways we typically understand knowledge is really the central way, you could say, that we understand knowledge is that it's something that belongs to a knower. And that is what TSK challenges. And another way of saying that is that we think of knowledge as being a subjective dimension of experience that is really cut off from and different from the objective aspects of experience. So we have this objective universe consisting of stars and planets and galaxies, and within planets we have mountains and oceans and so on. That's the objective universe. And if you suddenly imagined all forms of life were wiped out, you would still have that objective reality. But that's not the TSK understanding. The TSK understanding, I think, and this is not something Rinpoche says anywhere in the books, I don't think, but my sense is that you could imagine a situation in which all forms of life were wiped out, but it's totally theoretical. That's not the world that we live in. And the world that we live in is a world in which what we usually call the objective realm and what we usually call the subjective realm are completely interconnected. And that's why it makes sense to say that time and space are completely interconnected with and not separate from knowledge. They all arise together. And knowledge is also not separate from being, which is another way of saying it's not separate from time and space. And there's an interesting comment about that on the first page of the reading from Sacred Dimensions, or at least an interesting way of saying that, I think. Rinpoche talks at the very bottom of the page. He says, our lives are filled with countless reminders that time and space are more than we imagine. Despite the limiting identities we assign, the radiance of being shines through. The moment we look, a different kind of knowledge is available. And one way to understand that is to say that the knowledge that interests us, the knowledge that the vision is trying to activate, is exactly the radiance of being. This theoretical universe in which there was no life would not be radiant. It would be dead and dull. But the quality of knowing, of awareness, of inquiry, which is the way that, you know, inquiry is really the bridge through which we can come in contact with being, that quality, that's the radiance of being. And as he says here, we do our best to shut that down in a certain sense. We assign these identities and the purpose, not the purpose in the sense of why we do it, but the outcome of our way of knowing, which depends on assigning identities and then being able to recognize and acknowledge those identities. The purpose of, or the outcome of doing that is that we're cut off from the radiance of being. It's a very fundamental point, and it's easy to say, and I think it's even easy to appreciate the significance of it. The question, of course, becomes, what can we do about that? How can we cross the bridge, or how can we awaken to the radiance of being? And that's what the TSK vision is about. First, it allows for that possibility. It demonstrates in countless ways how that possibility can really guide us and inspire us, and then it encourages us to activate that possibility, to make it our reality, which leads to the first sentence of the reading, which is, at that point we discover within time and space beauty beyond measure and power beyond reckoning. So what is it, why is it that we can't connect with that? That's kind of the ongoing question. You know, it's very straightforward. It's very, the vision is absolutely available. We could inhabit a vision of reality that was shaped through this new way of engaging time and space and knowledge. There's nothing that prevents us from doing it. It's not a goal that we arrive at by pursuing a path. It doesn't have to be. But in fact, we are cut off from it. And the question is, how are we cut off from it? And the answer is suggested, or, you know, I hate to say things in a way that makes it sound black and white. So, you know, let me give you the answer. No, there's a suggestion as to why that's so. It's in the second sentence of the reading. It says, I'm going to turn it around a little bit. It says, we come to appreciate the beauty and power that time and space offer when knowledge can free itself from the barriers to understanding that we have imposed. And so that's really where we want to start. And what I'm going to do is spend a couple of minutes explaining or saying something about how it is that we impose those barriers, and the sense in which those barriers are really not as solid and substantial as they seem. And then we will do a practice where we try to discover that for ourselves, or look into it for ourselves. So we impose barriers to understanding. And how do we do that? Well, we do it in the moment we name something or label it or determine that this is the way things are. We do it in the moment that we establish a substantial reality. The very notion, and I want to take a little time to try to say this because it's really central. The very notion of substance, is something that we can't penetrate. The literal meaning of substance, and I'm not sure if this is how the term developed historically, but the literal meaning of substance is something that stands under what appears. So there's appearance, and then there's the substance, which is said to be the source of that appearance. And that notion is the problem in a nutshell. That's the whole issue. Because we can contact what appears, but we can't understand, or we can't contact what stands under that appearance. We can't contact the substance of appearance. So when we identify something and we say, this is that, you know, this is a cat, just in the most simple examples, we just do it all the time. That's what it means to learn to know in the ordinary sense of knowledge. We're just always assigning identities. And when we do that, we're creating or affirming the existence of these substances that are unknowable. We're shutting down knowledge. We're imposing barriers to understanding, to come back to the phrase that Rinpoche uses. So we create a substance, or you could say actually we imagine that we create a substance, because how substantial is that substance? We'll look at that in a moment. But we create a substance, and we give it this closed off quality. It's no longer available to us because of its substantial nature. Knowledge can't penetrate it. And then, of course, we have to know this substance that we've created. And we have all sorts of ways of knowing it, but they all come in from outside. You know, we can measure it, we can touch its surface, we can subject it to certain kinds of tests. You know, there's a famous image in Western science, at the very beginning of Western science, a man named Francis Bacon said the goal of science is to torture nature and get it to reveal its secrets. That's because we don't have any other way of doing it. You know, it's you can imagine it, you know, it's very common in our culture these days. It's an image that we use all the time, or think about torturing a terrorist to get him to reveal information. Well, the point is that substance, the way we conceive of it, has an essence, has something that must define what it is. And we have to get at it, and we can only do that from outside. So we do whatever it takes. But in fact, we've never gotten there. All we can do is, in the end, you know, we can force it to reveal something. But whether it's revealed the truth, we don't have any good way of knowing. We don't have any way of knowing. And that's because we've established substance as something that is essentially unknowable. So that's a big problem. However, the positive side of that is that it's something we've done, and it doesn't really have that much substance to it. Let me just note that Michael here puts the issue in a nutshell. I hope the guys who are not native English speakers know that expression. To put something in a nutshell means to kind of get to the heart of it. The problem in a nutshell, says Michael, is that the nut is also a shell? Question mark. Yeah, I think that's a very nice way of putting it. It reminds me of an image that Rinpoche used once, one of the first times I ever saw Rinpoche speak. He used the image of a nut and its shell, and he said, the transformation happens when you crack open the shell and get to the nut. And you could say that cracking open the nutshell is recognizing that the nut is also a shell. You know, that's a nice way of thinking about it. And it's a good image. So we establish substance. That's how we impose our barriers. But that act of establishing a substance is kind of a phony. It's kind of a fraud. Because we claim to be able to do that. But what we're doing really when we do that is we're using the capacity for knowing in a certain way. Again, the underlying assumption that we have, and it's an assumption that's really kind of hard to escape, is that we own knowledge, you know, that we make use of knowledge, or we have this capacity for knowledge. And it's very helpful to start to start to think about it differently, more in accord with TSK, you could say, and to say that knowledge is available. Knowledge is always available, but we don't own it. And when we, I'm just going to back up for a minute and say that you could call that the radiance of being. Being is always radiant. It's always radiating knowingness. And then we use it in certain ways. And in the course of using it, or in the moment we start to use it, we claim ownership over it. So when we impose this barrier, when we create substance, it's just knowledge in action. And in that sense, the identity that we assign when we say this is this, you know, this is a cat, this is a table, this is freedom, whatever terms we use, that's just an activity of knowing. And it's and that's why we could say, you know, that the nut remains the shell, or that the nut in the end doesn't have any substance other than knowledge. And the reading says that very specifically, not exactly in those words, on page 21. Let's see if I can find it here. It says, I thought I had it marked and I don't. Oh, it's because it's not 29. Okay, it's 26. I misread it. The reading's on the phrase I'm looking for is on 26. And it says in the first full paragraph, whatever we know or experience as real. And here, I think the word real is pretty much the same as the word substance that I've been talking about. Whatever we know or experience as real is also an object of human knowledge, so the particular kind of knowledge that we think of as human knowledge. Since we have named it, so we as human beings have named it, we know that it depends on the naming power of the mind. Since we experience it, we know then it arises out of our ability to interact with it, with whatever appears. In other words, reality as we know it must reflect our own capacity for knowledge. And then he goes on to say, this doesn't mean that the mind creates reality, but it does mean that mind and what the mind knows are inseparable. So knowledge is always active, and even when we impose a barrier to knowing by assigning a name and creating something that in that very act is presented as being unknowable, it's still just knowledge. It's, you know, there's, I don't remember the specifics, but there's, there are certain experiments they do in particle physics where they create objects that are too, hot, I think it is, to be placed in any container, because they just immediately burn their way through any container. And the way that they're able to handle them, the way that they're able to run experiments on them is by creating a field of force that holds it in place. So there's no entity there, that holds it. And yet it's held. It would be helpful if I could give you more specifics, but then we wind up talking about that more than I want to. The point is that that's kind of a nice image. At least I think it's a useful image. The way that we identify something, that we give it an identity and make it substantial is, in effect, it's sort of like tying a knot in knowledge. We turn it into something that seems to be different from the knowing activity, but it still really is just the knowing activity. So I've dwelt on that a little bit because it's so important. You know, if it were true, then we'd be stuck. And virtually all forms of philosophy and even I think you could say most forms of religion kind of are based on the idea that there is something substantial and we have to establish a relationship with it. And in one way you could say, well, we can't establish a relationship, so then we have to figure out some other way to connect with it. And I'm not going to lay out all the different possibilities, but you could kind of work that out for yourself. The TSK vision is different. The TSK vision says there's nothing substantial that has ever been established. It's all knowledge. It's all the radiance of being, which is knowledge, and which manifests in the interplay, the dynamic of time and space. So that's why I've wanted to really spend some time on this. That's the heart of the knowledge dimension, it seems to me. Okay, so still on page 19, still at the beginning of the chapter, Rinpoche says, and I think I read this sentence, the last sentence on the page, he says, the moment we look, a different kind of knowledge is available. So this is the knowledge that manifests the radiance of being, or that is inseparable from the radiance of being. Let's take a look at what a comment Bruce says has here. He says, I've been struggling a bit with whether there is still an important insight in the substance narrative, even if it isn't exactly right. Okay. For instance, in relationship, isn't it important for me to assume that my present knowing of you doesn't sum up or encapsulate the whole of who you are? If I treat someone as nothing more than how they appear to me, my knowledge of them, I think we run into ethical issues, among other things. Well, that's a really good question. The answer, as I see it, is that to know with the knowing that we can define for right now is the radiance of being, the inherent radiance of being, is not my knowing. And it's not me summing up what that person is in a particular way. If I engage another person, or in any kind of relationship, the depth of that knowing is inseparable from the depth of that person's being. This is kind of an ideal, you could say, but the ideal is that knowing completely is to engage the whole of what is known, or even to be the whole of what is known. And so I don't think, ethical issues come up when you have two beings, this one and that one, and they have to connect with each other. At the very fundamental level that we're talking about now, that model doesn't work. There's a oneness, an inherent oneness. And so even a term like love, let's say, or any of the other terms we use in ethical discourse, are in a sense too limiting if they are based on the idea that there's someone who loves something, or there's someone who treats another person ethically. It doesn't come up in that way. So Michael's asking here, any kind of looking manifests knowing? ? And looking at how we know allows knowledge to be recognized as being on both sides of the looking? Yes, I think that's right. I think it doesn't, you might say it doesn't capture the whole of what's being said here, but it's definitely moving in the right direction. The moment we look, and that's what Rinpoche says here at the bottom of page 19, the moment we look, a different kind of knowing is available. And the simplest act of looking already manifests that knowing. But our ordinary way of looking, which presupposes structures and substance and so on, manifests it in a rather limiting and limited way. So there's a kind of a progression or a continuum there, degrees of looking. But in principle, the very act of looking does manifest the radiance of being. The availability, the absolute availability of knowledge. And what you say is right, that you know, we see that when we recognize that knowledge is on both sides of the looking. Okay. So, how do we look? Well, the first point I want to make, and Rinpoche does mention this, if not here, he certainly says it in many, many places, is that that sense of a deeper, a more complete knowing is something we come across all the time. And he does say something like that. He says, now I can't find it at the moment, but he does say that we have an inborn, this is an inborn capacity, and we do have experiences that lead in this direction or that suggest this availability. And that seems very important, because if we didn't have a sense that our ordinary way of knowing is limited, there would be nothing to do. There'd be no place to go. There'd be no possibilities. You know, if you think that the way things are is the way things are, you're in trouble, because there's no way out. And that's why I, a few weeks ago, or maybe in the last session, I pointed to this phrase in the first TSK book in the discussion of first level space, when he says, what you have to activate in TSK basically is a sense that there are other possibilities. You experience, perhaps in an ordinary way, but in light of other possibilities. And that light of other possibilities, if we take the term literally, what is the source of that light? How does its luminosity enter our lives? Well, maybe the easiest thing to say is that it happens spontaneously. There are times when the universe seems more alive, more charged with knowing, more charged with love, more charged with awareness. It manifests in many, many different ways. And we recognize that things could be different. But of course, what we want to do is find a way to activate a different knowing, and then let that new possibility develop in as many ways as possible. That's what the TSK vision is all about. And that's the passage that I already pointed to earlier, on page 24, let's go back to it for a moment, but he says, the whole of the TSK vision is to question, right? The TSK vision invites us to initiate our own questioning and to judge for ourselves how valuable such inquiry can be. That is the whole of its message. And maybe I should go on and read a little more, because it relates to Bruce's question. He says, once the qualities of knowingness are in operation, the clarity at which philosophy aims, the radiant purity that inspires ethical conduct, and the penetrating certainty sought in certain religious traditions develop of their own accord as an outpouring of vitality and sensitivity. And maybe you could say, or add to that, that vitality and sensitivity are themselves aspects of the radiance of being, which is, I'm using right now as a kind of summary term for the possibility of, let's say, great knowledge, even though that terminology is not used right here. But the knowledge that we're interested in, that we're after. So, we do our own questioning, and we see where that leads us. And if we're willing to question, leads in a very fruitful direction. That's what TSK is suggesting. Okay. So, The point, the way of looking, or the way of questioning, of course, in order to make a difference, we have to be able to question at a fundamental level. And that actually ties in well. There's all sorts of interesting clues in language, I think. As you know, I like working with language and playing with language. And, a fundamental question is a foundational question. When we're looking at the foundation, we're starting to investigate substance. We're starting to look at what underlies our ordinary appearance or our assumptions about ordinary experience. So we need to be able to question in this fundamental way. And that's one reason you could say that we look in terms of time and space. You could do that kind of questioning in a very immediate, direct way. You know, it could just open up for you. And that happens to people, with people. But you may need to spend, you may need to kind of dedicate yourself to inquiry. And in a way, being on the TSK path is to dedicate yourself to inquiry. I think that's a fair way to say it. Michael has a comment which is directed to Bruce, but also to everybody. He says, I like the way you see in the impulse to attribute substance. We're going to that question. Very important question. I like the way you see in the impulse to attribute substance, standing beneath how we interpret something, a gesture that tries to acknowledge the mysterious unknown. Yeah, putting it that way, I think that's very nicely put. And I think that's true. You could say whenever we name something, you could also understand that as a gesture of knowledge. And in a sense, every act of naming is trying to escape its own limits. You know, we see something, we identify it, we know it, and we say the identity of what's known is the whole of the act of knowing it. You know, once we've known something, when I know the clock, that is, I see it, and I know that it's there, that's all that the act of knowing is good for. It got its result, and so we don't pay any attention to it. But if in fact you stayed with the act of knowing, not the outcome of the act when we've identified something, you'd be right in the heart of knowledge. So, and I think that's how I understand what Michael's saying here. The impulse to attribute substance is a gesture that tries to acknowledge the mysterious unknown. And as you say, this is still Michael, it doesn't quite manage to capture what we would like to discover. Okay. And Bruce, I'm reading these because, as you know, not everybody's online, and so they don't see the chat. So he says, yes, that's what I'm getting at. The substance thing narrative might not be right, but there is a recognition of the unknown. Now, I might say there's a cognition of the unknown. You know, in the narrative, we know what's going on, but we don't necessarily recognize what we know. Because recognizing, again, this is a little bit of playing with words, but recognizing has to do with fitting something in to what we already know. We recognize it as such and such. But let's not stay there. I do want to go on to practice. And actually, the practice that I want us to do is the practice that I suggested you do during the week. I'm going to say it's not an easy practice. I don't know how you found it. I don't want to prejudge the issue, but it's a subtle practice, let's put it that way. So the practice, the way that I assigned it, and I think it's from the language of the TSK book, the practice is to be aware of what's present without locating it in a before-after causal nexus. So this is right at the heart of what it is that we've been talking about. Because ordinarily, when I look at something, it's not as though I think this through. It's not as though this is you know, a dialogue I'm having with myself. But when I look at something, let's say I see the clock. There's a clock in front of me, so that's an image I'm using. I see the clock, and I see it as being there. But I presuppose a causal nexus. How did it get to be there? It's a very, very small shadow, you could say, on the edge of what it is that I see. Mostly I just see the clock. But I know how it got to be there, or I could kind of think it through, or you know, maybe I'm in a room and I see something and I have never been in the room. I don't know how it got to be there. But I nonetheless have a kind of, make a set of assumptions about how it got to be there. And that's the before-after causal nexus. And also, of course, the fact that whatever I see is going to be there. So this is related to our usual temporal structure, and we looked at that more in the last couple of weeks, of past and present and future. Whenever I engage the present, I presuppose this relationship with the past and the future. And that is the limit that we impose. That's how we create substance. Because, and I don't know if this is said exactly this way, although I'm about to read a passage which points towards it, creating substance has to do with accepting a story about past and present and future as unfolding in a linear sequence. For something to be substantial, it has to manifest within that past, present, future nexus. So if I have a hallucination, for instance, the reason it's a hallucination, the reason I count it as that, is because there is no causal nexus. It just suddenly shows up. Or something suddenly disappears, right? When that happens, we say, well, it must not have been real. It wasn't substantial. So the very notion of substance presupposes the idea of ordinary linear time. And Rinpoche suggests that when he talks on page 20, when he says, let's see, it's the second, the third paragraph. He says, at present, we are bound to a particular understanding of space and time, one that makes certain limits seem very real. For instance, we accept that time unfolds from one moment to the next, that our thoughts can only move from one type of thing to another in a predictable sequence, and that specific events invariably take a fixed length of time. All of that has to do with all of that has to do with the claim of substance that we're ordinarily making. So when you look, so the walkabout practice was be aware of what's present without locating it in the before-after causal nexus. And that's why I say that it's a subtle practice, because you see something, you just automatically locate it. And it's just that little, as I said, it's kind of a shadow at the edge. Little border at the edge of what you see. Well, of course, it arose out of a past, you know, in a causal way, and it's headed toward a future. And what we want to do, the practice, the walkabout practice, and what we're going to try right now, again, is see if we can know without that nexus. So I think the first thing to do is look for the nexus. Look for how past and future are implicated in the present, and there's the causal sense of it. There are two separate elements, but they're very, very closely related. So look for how the past and the future are implicated, are involved in the present, and then see if it's possible to unknow that nexus. Let's try that. Let's try that for, since, you know, take a moment to kind of try to become aware of the nexus and then see what happens if you try to unknow it. We'll give ourselves about 3 minutes for that, okay? Okay. So, as always, I'll invite you to comment on that, either audio or in the chat box. What did you notice? Yeah. Yes, Hayward. Interesting. Okay. So I'm going to repeat that again, because when people speak, it doesn't show up the right way in the recording. So Hayward said when he looked around the room, he realized that the objects he was looking at, the reason he knew them was because of the causal nexus. He knew what they had been in the past. And he wasn't really able to strip that away, but he had the thought that if he did or could strip it away, he wouldn't know what anything was anymore. I'm going to leave that open. I don't think that's necessarily true, but I do understand the distinction, and I think you're right to say that the identities we assign are past identities. And I think I've said this before, but again, to go to the language, the word identity means same, like identical. When we assign something an identity, we say that it's the same as what we knew it was a minute ago, or we knew it was in the past. That's what it means, to know our way around. Now, okay, I guess I will comment on why that wouldn't be necessary. I don't think that's a problem if you unknow it. What you would know if you unknew the nexus is the claim of identity. The appearance would be there, but it wouldn't have the same weight. So Michael says here, memory hold the door. I don't know if that's a command or if it should say memory holds the door. Oh, okay. Maybe saying it again. Memory can open a door into new experience. Yes, and in fact, you may have lurking in the background of your thinking the image that Rinpoche uses, which is basically that image. He assigns it to space. It's on page 23. He's at the bottom of 22. He's been saying that if we can cultivate this inquiry, which gets at the fundamentals, then we discover new knowledge and new time and new space. We can command appearance differently. And then he said at the top of 23, all this happens of its own accord. It's as though space has been holding open the door. Time has been waiting for us to dive in more deeply, and knowledge has patiently held itself available until the moment we are ready to ask. So, right. I think it's a very good question to ask. We have this way of knowing, and we may have, and now we're saying, well, we could let that go. And the question is, what would we lose if we did? Would we lose anything at all? Now, I'm not sure, Michael, that I actually have given enough weight to your comment, though. You say memory can open a door into a new experience. I'm not. Are you pointing toward the fact that memory itself is a kind of a present, and if we let go of a causal nexus, that itself becomes a new experience? That's what my take on it would be. But maybe that's not what you meant. So say more. Yes? Okay. So, okay, I think I understand. So the memory or the associations we make, or it doesn't have to be a causal nexus in the kind of limiting sense that we're talking about here. It can be another dimension, an opportunity for appreciation and delight. I'm paraphrasing and shortening a bit, but okay. Couple of other comments here. John Brossard says, "I like how letting go of the causal nexus makes my experience of the world more magical, and my experience of me more free and innocent." Well, those are exactly the kinds of descriptions that Rinpoche gives of what's happened, of what happens when you can let go of that causal nexus. And here, I think it's become more clear in the comments that people have been making. The sense of causal nexus is the sense of limiting and tying down, identifying and naming, and placing within a certain structure. And TSK and inquiry and the TSK vision is all about saying all of that can be called into question. It doesn't have to be thrown away, it doesn't have to be rejected, but its substance and solidity can be called into question. So Brigitte says, nearly impossible. Yeah, I said this is a subtle practice and maybe a difficult practice. I felt that the nexus was very strongly connected with the sense of me. If I loosened the feeling of me, then the nexus also got weaker. All became more of a mash or a flowing something. Yeah, in English we have this sort of nice expression, a mishmash. Everything got all mashed up or flowing. Yeah, I think, well, there may be all sorts of experiences that come up if you loosen the nexus. They aren't necessarily the final word, but new possibilities open. That's really, I think, about all I'm going to say, especially because we really are out of time. I want to say make one comment, and then we'll stop for today. And it's just not exactly related to what we've been talking about, but there's such this very strong sense that knowledge is inseparable from being. And the kind of knowledge that we cultivate, and especially in our culture, the kind of knowledge we cultivate, is a different knowledge in which the separation from being is presupposed. What I think is interesting about what's happening in our culture with this very strong dimension now of virtual reality, imposing knowledge on reality, so that it's not quite here yet, but very soon people will walk down the street and there'll be sort of a steady set of identities and labels that are imposed by your smartphone or your Google Glass or whatever it is on whatever you see. We will be taking the subjective knowledge that we rely on and colonizing reality. And it's interesting to compare that to what TSK is saying. It's in one way, it's exactly the opposite. And the fact that it's exactly the opposite, I think, may help clarify what it is that TSK is pointing towards. And I'm just going to leave it at that. I will cite one line that I've always liked at the pretty much at the end of the reading on page 27. Let me pull it out here. He says, TSK requires our full participation. And I think that's clear from what we've been saying. Can we strengthen knowledge through our questioning? Can we invite it into the innermost part of our own lives? Can we pound on the is of each ism and question each establishment? I've always liked that. It only works in English, but I like it. Pounding on the is of each ism. That's what this kind of inquiry is about. Okay, so people have been asking that in the orientations that I make more clear, what the assignment is for the week, and I will do that with the next one. I do have a commitment for the rest of today, and so I won't be able to write up the orientation until tomorrow. So it'll be put up a day late, but it'll be there. And next week, we'll continue with knowledge. Thank you very much.